Hi, Mike. This is RSS Ray. How you doing?
Hi, Ray. I'm glad to be here.
Me too. You know, Mike is Mike. And we're talking with Mike Moran. Mike's responsible for the search marketing for IBM, and also Mike has an upcoming book. Actually, a second. His first book, Search Marketing Inc., is one of the finest written on the topic of search marketing. That's really how Mike and I met almost 2 years ago. I had the opportunity to hear you speak, if you remember, in San Francisco. And we started to chat and really enjoy Mike a lot, which is why I'm doing this now. And you've got a book coming out in, what, September, Mike? September of 2007?
That's correct.
Yeah, and that book is called, titled, Do It Wrong Quickly. Correct? Got
yes.
The correct working title as well. And there's a lot of neat things in it. I've had an opportunity to read a preview copy of Mike's book, which is absolutely fabulous. And so I asked Mike to spend some time with me on the phone today so that we could share with you some things that will really kind of help you on your online marketing. So, Mike, let's kind of get started. If you would, please tell everybody listening a little bit about you and what some of your responsibilities are at IBM and how you got involved in this whole world of online marketing and search marketing.
Be glad to, Ray. I'm an IBM Distinguished Engineer, which basically is a technical executive at IBM. And so I have a really strong technical background. So I've been working on the web since its inception. And I spent 8 years at IBM.com in various roles where we were responsible for attracting traffic to the site and for getting customers to buy or to contact us so they can buy offline. And my most recent job at IBM.com was as manager of the web experience. So I was responsible for the designers and the information architects and the programmers and the webmasters and the technical architects. But in October, I took a new position at IBM. I'm now the product manager for IBM's OmniFine search engine, which means that I'm responsible for figuring out how to market that, and we market that online. We have a new product called OmniFine Yahoo Edition that we've done in conjunction with Yahoo, which is a free search engine that you can go download. And so I have a lot of experience doing internet marketing for many years, and it's always struck me that a lot of the technical things are things that business people don't understand, and a lot of the business stuff are things that the technical people don't understand. And when you're doing online marketing, you have to figure out how to bring both of those things together. And so that's been one of my motivations for writing Do It Wrong Quickly.
Let's move into that, Do It Wrong Quickly. I love the title. Tell us what the title of the book means.
Well, what it really means is that often I find people who are veteran marketers, they really, really know a lot about marketing. I mean, they've taught me a lot. I mean, I had to go back to school to learn marketing. I ended up getting a marketing certification in school because I realized I needed to know a lot more about marketing than I did. But I work with marketers who know way more than me, and what they've learned over the years is that the way to do marketing is to make sure that you get it right. So if you're planning a television campaign, you have to make the media buys ahead of time, so you have to pick the right shows to buy it on. It costs a lot of money to put these commercials together. It costs money to put print campaigns together, to do direct marketing. All of these things cost a lot of money, and you have to spend a lot of the money up front, and you have to make commitments up front to spend all this money. And so what you do is you end up obsessing over focus groups and testing and all the things that you have to do to make sure that this goes right. Because if it goes wrong, you've blown your whole budget for the year. You may embarrass yourself if you did something really dumb. And so you have to make sure you don't do anything wrong. And so there's a lot of work where, you know, you're sitting in the room going over and over the plan, and you have all these different people that have to approve it. You have to reach the dreaded consensus, and you're constantly working on this to make sure that you don't screw it up.
Yep.
And the problem is when you go to the web, you actually need to do the exact opposite. What you actually can do on the web is you can try something, and a day later you can say, well, that didn't work. Let's try something else. And it's a totally different environment. And I think this is a real difficult change for people. And what you need to do is to admit that everything that you're doing really is wrong. Your first try is usually wrong. And to be okay with that and to just say, hey, look, it's more important that we get something out there. It's more important that we start to get feedback from customers to see whether it's really working. It's more important that we try something quickly and see whether it's working. And if it's not, we'll change it. And we're going to keep changing it as fast as we can until we eventually lurch into the right answer. We don't have to be brilliant and come up with the thing. All we have to do is continue to listen to our customer, continuing to listen to what they say and to watch what they do, which the web lets you do in a way that you can't do it in any other media. And if you keep doing that, suddenly you're going to look brilliant because eventually you're going to find something that really clicks, and then you can just do more and more of that.
You know, Mike, in the book, Do It Wrong Quickly, you refer a lot to this thing called the new marketing communication. Can you tell people what you really mean by that and what its real significance is?
Well, there are many different ways of communicating with people online. And so some of the new marketing communication is about just how you do it. So search marketing is one way to communicate online where people are looking for something and you want your site to be found. Blogs are another way of communicating, podcasts. There are all these different things that are now springing up, which are new ways of communicating. Putting something on YouTube for viral marketing. There's all sorts of things that are going on, right? Now, are any of these things totally new? No, they're not. So to say it's the new market communication, I mean, in some ways it's new, but I mean, what's the difference between viral marketing and word of mouth? Not much. You're still getting people to pass your message along. So all of these things have predecessors, right? There's not much difference between trying to get search engines to find your website than trying to get your press release picked up by a newspaper. Basically, you're trying to interest some third party to distribute your message so that your customers will see it. So a lot of these things, marketers already understand the concepts of these things, but they don't know they do because nobody's explained it to them in a way that takes into account all the experience that they have. There are some things that are really new, though. The thing that they have to understand is that the way you do this communication is very different, that the old style of having kind of bombastic, hype-laden prose where you're promising all sorts of stuff and you know your new medication will solve world hunger, people aren't interested in that anymore. Nobody wants to hear about that, and they really punish that kind of stuff online. They're willing to kind of give you a pass on TV, but they're not willing to give you a pass online. Online, they expect you to be a lot more factual, and so there's several different things that you need to look at online to change the tone of what you do instead of trying to do things the old-fashioned way. I mean, I think a lot of marketers look at the Internet and they just say to themselves, well, technology always changes. I mean, you know, when TV came in, we had to adjust. When cable came in, we had to adjust. You know, there's radio, satellite radio. You know, you just have to change the way you buy the stuff. And, you know, once you understand that, you're okay. The Internet's actually different. You have to change the way you do it, not just how you do it. And so those are the kinds of things that marketers really need to understand.
We're going to talk about that in a few more minutes. Let's talk first, though, Mike. Let's get some background stuff that you do a great job covering in the book that people really need to understand. And first, let's talk about, you know, what tell us about the impact that the Internet and computers have had on marketing segmentation.
That's a really interesting one to me. I really like that one. I think it
me
might
too.
Be partially my background in search, but
mm-hmm.
one of the things that's really happened is that if you look at how market segmentation works in traditional environments, a lot of it is based on characteristics. So if you're a B2B marketer, you're breaking people down by industry and company size. If you're a consumer marketer, you're looking at age and gender and geography, and there's a lot of different factors that you use, but mostly it's on characteristics. You do often you try and take a shot at doing need-based segmentation, but it's hard. It's not that easy to know what to do. It's not that easy to know what need somebody is going to have if you put an ad in a magazine. you might be able to do a better job of understanding demographics than you might of being able to understand what needs these people have. On the web, it's totally the opposite. On the web, it's actually harder to find out what their age and gender is than to find out what their need is. On the web, it's really easy to know what their need is. I mean, if you do search marketing, for example, they're telling you what their need is. They're typing in some words that say, here's what I need, and you know what? I need it right now. And for you to be able to figure out how you'd have different kinds of marketing messages based on which search terms people type in is very, very interesting to me. The other thing that's interesting is once they come to your site, you can use technology to personalize even more. So, for example, you can put a list of choices on the screen, so a list of links. And by the words you use, you can actually get customers to segment themselves. So you can put up for example, at IBM, one of the things we did was we had a list of characteristics of the training courses that we offer. And so you can tell us what subject of course you're interested in by clicking on, okay, that's the one I want out of this list. You can say, I'm more interested in an in-person class than one that's shipped to me on a CD or that's done online. And you can click all these different interests. And when they do that, they're narrowing down exactly which courses they want to see on the screen. And so they're actually segmenting themselves. They're telling us, here's exactly the segments that I fit into. I'm the kind of person who's interested in this kind of information. I'm interested in this kind of delivery of the course. And you can remember that stuff so that the next time they come back, you know a little bit better what kinds of things to pitch to them. So that person could come back to you in a week and be looking at a totally different part of your website. But because you know that they have an interest in this stuff, the little ad that you put on the right side of the screen might be pitched to exactly what they told you about themselves a couple of weeks ago. And so this kind of self-segmentation to me is something that's very, very interesting on the internet, and it's something that you really don't have in any of the other media right now. And I think that's how marketers really need to think about what they're doing, and because you can actually get to the point where you have a market segment of one, where you really know so much about a certain person coming to your site that they're going to see things on the site that other people wouldn't see. And that is when you really are becoming relevant and getting people to really focus on what your message is because it's interesting to them.
Talk a little bit, Mike, about what impact the Internet has had on direct marketing.
I think that the Internet has had a big impact on direct marketing. I think it's had a bigger impact on direct marketers because I think that direct marketing was kind of the backwater of marketing. I mean, I have enormous respect for direct marketers. To me, the stuff that they have done with as little measurement as is possible offline is amazing, that they actually come up with things that say, okay, you know, the guy who came up with the idea for the yellow sticky on that says, don't throw me away yet. I mean,
right.
That guy's in the Marketing Hall of Fame because he raised response rates by 0.4% every time he put that yellow sticky on his direct mail piece. And so the focus that they have on response and understanding what their return on investment is, I just think has been incredible. And it's really hard to measure that kind of stuff in offline. There aren't that many touch points. On the web, you can measure all this stuff. You can know how many people went from page A to page B to page C, and you can know what they clicked on, and you know what was on that page when they looked at it, and if you changed it the next day, you can see whether people did more or less of it. And so the biggest impact is that I think direct marketers are getting paid a lot more because there's so much more competition for that kind of skill. Those people can come to the web and really be able to have enormous amounts of information to analyze and really be able to help people drive decisions of how they can improve their conversion rate. And I think that is really what the biggest impact has been. And more the people with direct marketing skills are going to move online because it is so much cheaper online than it is in direct marketing. I mean, it costs over $9 to get a lead from direct marketing, and it costs under 50 cents for search. And so if you think about that, all those skills that people apply in direct marketing can be applied to any of the online marketing as well. And so I think more and more you're going to see direct marketers moving to being interactive marketers.
You know, now, Mike, in your book, Do It Wrong Quickly, that's coming out in September of 2007, you talk a lot about this thing called social marketing. Tell us what that's all about.
I think social marketing is a big topic, and one of the things that's a little confusing about it is that there are many different ways of doing social marketing. And so if you think about it, what's really happening is that in the early parts of the web was really used for what I call the learning phase for the customer. So it's the phase where the customer is already aware of that they have a need, and now they're trying to research and trying to figure out what it is that they're going to try and buy to solve that need. And frequently you would go offline to make that sale. And so the web is kind of in this middle area where it's good for the middle part, but the beginning part where you actually become aware of the thing and the end part where you actually go buy it is less likely to happen on the web. Social marketing actually brings more of that discovery part, that awareness part, to the web. So it's more likely that social marketing is going to become a way of learning about things the same way that a TV ad or a print ad would bring something to your attention nowadays. So if you look at MySpace and other kinds of social networking sites, those are ways for people to talk to each other. So if you can come up with a message that causes people to want to talk to each other about it, those are the places where they gather where they're going to do that. If you have content that's really, really strong, it makes a good point about something, or it helps people really understand what problem your product solves. It really explains that problem in detail. Then social marketing is going to allow that content to be marked in Dig or in Delicious or one of the social bookmarking sites. And so people are then going to see it more, because people who are then using those sites to find information about subjects they're interested in are going to use that to figure out that they should come to your page and look at it. And so to me, social marketing is going to become more and more important. I mean, the younger the person is, the more likely they're using some social marketing facilities today. And so as the years go by, more and more people are going to be using this social marketing because all these facilities are things your customers are now starting to use, and they're going to become the way that they become aware of you for the first time.
Let me make sure I'm summarizing this right and I'm understanding, Mike. Basically, social marketing are either gathering places where people talk about things, or else there's some sort of a reference point, so that if you wanted to know, for example, what RSS Ray was interested in, you might go to one of the places that I've put a list or my favorite things or something along that line, correct?
That's correct. I mean, the social part of it is that it has to do with people connecting with other people.
Right.
But because they're on the web, the way those people connect with other people is through information, right? So it's you're finding a person who is recommending something, right? So it could be that you've gone to somebody's MySpace profile and seen some things that they're talking about. It could be that you went to Dig and you looked at what the front page of Dig stories today were, and what you've really seen is here are all the stories that other Dig readers are recommending today. And so it's basically a way of allowing people to recommend things for other people. And so marketers are increasingly interested in figuring out what is the kind of things that they can do to get recommended. And so that goes back to some of the things I talked about in terms of tone, right? You're not going to have people recommending you if you just have this bloviated prose that worked really well offline. That kind of stuff is not really tolerated online. And so how do you have to change the way that you talk about your product and your customers and the problems that your customers have? How do you have to change the way you talk about all those things so that all these people will recommend you, so they will give you this word-of-mouth boost?
Let's dive into that a little bit, Mike. Tell us a little bit, how do customers start conversations today? How does this all happen from a customer's perspective?
I have broken down advice there into what I call the three R's. I think you have to be real, you have to be relevant, and you have to be responsive. And so let's take each one in turn. So when I say you have to be real, I mean you have to be authentic. You have to have a human voice. So people are not looking to read your press releases. What they would like to read is an interview with one of your product designers where the product designer explains what she was thinking when she designed it a certain way, how she figured that out, why she thinks that's what customers want, that they want to read, because it's a human being who has a point of view. They're also, the other way you have to be real is you have to be honest. You can't be trying to cover up mistakes. Instead, you have to embrace your mistakes. That's part of do it wrong quickly, is you're going to make mistakes. You have to apologize if it was bad and change it. And so you have to explain to people, hey, look, we had a tin ear on that one, sorry, but, you know, now we got it. We understand what you said, we understand what you're doing, and now we're going to do it better. We're going to do it different. We're going to listen to you and do what you need. And that's the responsive part. You have to respond. You have to be engaged. You have to be monitoring what people are doing out there. You have to monitor what they're saying about you in the blogosphere. You have to monitor what they're saying about your products. I mean, I would tell every company to put ratings and reviews on their site, even manufacturers. I mean, Sun Microsystems has put out ratings and reviews for their products. I mean, it's a very brave thing to do, right? Because, I mean, retailers do it, but they just figure if you say lousy things about one, you'll buy something about the other. But it's really more important for manufacturers to do it. And let's use that feedback and go fix the products. And that's a way to be real, and it's also a way to be responsive. You also need to be relevant. And being relevant means that you can't be interrupting people anymore. I mean, the way marketing has worked up until now is that I'm sitting there minding my own business watching a television program, and all of a sudden there's an ad for Viagra on there, and I may or may not be interested in that. And so I kind of deal with the fact that they're interrupting me watching my program, but that wasn't my purpose. On the web, people don't have any appetite for interruption. That's why people hate spam email so much. What they really want is relevant advertising. So they want you to be coming up when they type in a search. They want you to have something that's personalized to them. They want you to have a message that really is something they're interested in. And so it's a lot more work for you to figure out how to be interesting and how to get their attention. But the truth is that on the web, everybody has a choice as to what they see. They can block almost any way that you have of interrupting them. I mean, it used to be that they would try and do pop-up ads, and there's all sorts of ways that people would try and interrupt. But interruption doesn't work that well on the web. The technology favors the customer being able to choose what they look at. So you have to figure out how can I change the way I do messaging so that they choose to read what I have to say.
Let's talk about that. You know, how do I get started doing these conversations? How can a marketer get moving with it?
Well, I mean, it depends on where you are and what kind of business you have, but most companies have businesses in which they know a lot more information about what they're doing than they ever tell. And so, I mean, I remember I had a company come to me that is just a regular small business. They sell furniture, and they sell nice furniture. They sell it from several different manufacturers from around the country, and they said, what's wrong with our website? We don't seem to be selling a lot from our website. So I went and looked at it, and at first there didn't seem to be anything wrong with the website. They had nice pictures up there of all the furniture, and they had a website that I could say, hey, if I needed a chair, I could go click on chairs, and I'd see all the chairs, and I could click on tables and see all the tables. But after I looked at it a couple of minutes, I said, okay, this basically looks like a catalog, and maybe a better website wouldn't look like a catalog. Maybe a better website would actually talk about, hey, we know that it's hard for you to pick out furniture. So we'll offer you some design advice. If you tell us what kinds of things you have, then we'll tell you what would match. And you don't have to pick out a chair and a table. Here's some sets that all go together. Here's what kind of room these would really go well in. And here's some problems that customers have had in the past that they were trying to solve, and here's the furniture we sold them to solve it. And so by putting that kind of information out there, you're going to attract a whole set of people who have no idea how to pick their furniture. They don't know what to buy. They're not experts in this. They don't know whether they want oak or mahogany. They have no clue. And what they do know is that their dining room table is really old, and they want to replace it. And they just redid the room, and they know what colors it is, but they have no idea whether they need a dark wood or a light wood. And that's about the level that they've got. And if you can actually find these people and solve their problems, you're going to get a very loyal clientele. And these are the kinds of things that we take for granted in a retail store. If those people walked into their retail store and started talking about this stuff, then everybody would say, oh, gee, okay, yeah, we know how to help you. Well, these people are coming to your website, and all they get is a catalog. And so what they really need is they really need to have their problem solved. So you need to think deeply. Go back and talk to your salespeople on the sales floor and say, okay, what are the kinds of customers that walk in, and what are the kinds of things you do to help them, and what kind of design advice do we give them? Because I know we've got these designers that we have back there that have done all that great work and give a lot of design advice, and what do we say to them? What is the normal things that people struggle with? And then you need to write all this stuff down, and you need to show pictures, and you need to tell stories of happy customers and how they got through their problem and solved it. And suddenly, you're going to have a conversation. Suddenly, you're going to have a lot of ways of people talking about things. I mean, why not put up some way for customers to post their own stories or to rate your products or to say, here's the problem I have, and you fixed it. Put all that stuff in there. Make your website into the place that hosts that conversation, and suddenly you're going to find a lot more people coming there and a lot more people buying.
Mike, in the book, Do It Wrong Quickly, you talk about some things that marketers should avoid doing. Can you elaborate a little bit or give us a preview of what some of those are?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we've talked about before is, you know, to avoid kind of the hype-laden prose. I mean, that stuff really goes over like a lead balloon on the web. But the other thing to do is to kind of avoid any kind of fakery at all. So, I mean, there's some companies that have gotten into trouble recently because they basically faked blogs. So what they did was their advertising agency hired people to write a blog as though they were an average person. I mean, this happened to Walmart. It happened to Sony. And so their advertising agency hired these people, and so they basically were writing these nice things about Walmart and these nice things about Sony's products. And what was really true was they were just being paid by the advertising agency to do that. And so so when people found out, and inevitably these things are found out, then the backlash was just horrific. And so that's the kind of thing that is kind of a little too tricky. And so what you really need to do is just accept the fact that you don't have message control anymore. Message control is dead. And instead, you can't control anything. Just as if a customer walked in to talk to you, you wouldn't be saying to yourself, well, I have to control this conversation. You wouldn't. You'd just be talking to them, and whatever they said, you would say something back. And you wouldn't be trying for message control. You'd be trying for a relationship. And that's what you need to do. And so every time you find yourself trying to control the message and stay on message, that's when you're losing. When you're winning is when you're in relationship, when a customer has a problem and you can answer it, and answer it honestly. And, I mean, the honest answer might have been, I am really sorry we screwed that up. Because in the past, you could hide things like that because customers would have to call you on the phone or show up at the complaint department. Now they post on a public message board and say, this company stinks, and here's why. And so you want to be monitoring that and help them and answer them publicly. You want to have those public conversations. And I know they're painful, right? I mean, nobody wants to be in public and being called out for a mistake, but the truth is that that's already happening. And your choice is, am I going to respond to this and really help this customer? And by the way, you're doing it in public and showing all your other customers how you respond and that you're more willing to have a relationship than you're willing to kind of hide from the problem to kind of assuage your own ego. And so that's something that's really a big shift that has to go on. Is that's part of being responsive and being real, is you have to just engage with customers this way. And it absolutely goes against the fiber of of everybody who does this stuff. It's very hard to do. You have to really change the way you look at things and become much more customer-oriented. This isn't for the salespeople or the complaint department anymore. It's for the marketers, too.
You know, Mike, one of the things that you alluded to is that somebody could post something on a message board about your company. How does a business listen to these online conversations? How can they find out what's being said, and how do they listen?
If you're a big company that has lots and lots of stuff being said about you, there are consultants that will actually sell you software that will monitor this stuff for you and you can look at it. But for small companies, you can do really simple stuff. I mean, there's a thing called a free thing called a Google Alert. You go to the Google site and you look for alerts, and what it does is it'll send you an email every time some words are mentioned on a page that Google sees. And since Google sees almost all the pages, that's pretty good. And so if you have a fairly unique company name, or you want to put in your own name and just see every time somebody's talking about you, every time somebody's talking about your company, you want to put in the list of all the product names that you have. So anytime they're talking about this stuff, you'll get an email that says, oh boy, you know, 2 days ago somebody posted on this message board, you know, asking this question. And then you can go there and answer the question. Or you can go there and find that people are saying all sorts of lousy stuff about you, and maybe you have a problem that you really need to fix, because you can't just get away with this with lousy service anymore. You have to make sure that you're engaged in listening. I mean, Dell had a great response when they got called out for really bad service a while back. They not only worked really hard to fix it, because you have to do that. I mean, you have to actually address the problem. But they also started a blog where they have said to people, hey, look, we know we had a problem with service. We're really sorry about that. Here are the things we're doing to address it. And so they're not only fixing it quietly, which is what used to happen, but they're also fixing it publicly. And they're saying, hey, look, we heard you. We understand. That's not the company that we want to be. We want to be this kind of company, and give us a chance, and we're going to get it done. Now, they have to actually get it done in order for that to work, but that's really what you need to do. You need to not only fix the problem, but you need to answer.
Mike, in the book, you talk about three different listening styles, I believe, that marketers should have. I believe you refer to them as daily, crisis, and war. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Yeah, daily listening is kind of the stuff that that I was referring to before. So it could be something that, you know, you use Google Alerts, or you use one of these specialized companies that can listen to things that are going on. It just means that you are taking the pulse of your customers, that there's conversations that are already out there going on about you, whether they're in blogs or on message boards or wherever they are. They're already there. They're already happening. Your choice is whether you're going to be listening to them and participating, and that's kind of the everyday listening that you have to do. So you have to suddenly realize that you need to be part of the conversation that's going on about you. Listening in a crisis is a little different. So in a crisis, like somebody has put a blog entry out that says that your product isn't working in some way, or that it's dangerous, or that you build it using child labor in Thailand. I mean, those are bad stories. You don't want to let those stories just sit out there, right? And I mean, it used to be that the only time those stories would get out there is when you were a big enough company and it was a big enough story that the media would pick up on it. And even then, you probably had some time, right? Unless you were a really big company, the media picking up on it might be the monthly industry magazine. And so you'd have a month in order to get yourself together and figure out how to do that. Or at least the reporter would call you up and say, okay, we're going to go with this story in a week. You know, we'd really like to get your response. And you'd have some time to really get yourself together. On the web, you don't have any time to get yourself together. You have to immediately respond and just respond the best you can. And your response could be, hey, look, we didn't know anything about this. We don't even know if it's true. But if it is true, then we're going to have to address it for sure. I mean, so you can just give a response that says, hey, look, we heard you. We're listening. We know what's going on. We're on it. We don't know what we're going to do yet, but we'll let you know as soon as we do. And you have to really be aggressive about answering those kinds of things. So you have to do it, because the rest of your customers are watching. And you might say to yourself, hey, look, I'm a small company. Who's going to care that I have some bad behavior over here, or I didn't do this right, or whatever? And the answer is that your customers are going to care, because they're the ones that are likely involved in this conversation. If somebody on a blog is writing about your industry, even if you're a fairly small company, but they write about you, the people reading that blog are the exact ones that you don't want to hear about this. And so you have to be in there, and you have to be responsive, and you have to be thinking about this. And that's what you have to do in a crisis. I mean, use the Tylenol example from the 80s, right? What did they do? They immediately said, hey, hey, we're recalling everything because we don't know what happened and this is horrible and it's dangerous and we're going to do the right thing. And they have gotten good PR out of that for decades, even though it turned out not to have anything to do with them. It was not their fault. Nothing they did was wrong. But, you know, they said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take everything in. We're going to make sure that nobody can tamper with this stuff ever again. And turned out wasn't their fault, but they got a lot of PR from that. So that's what you do in a crisis. In a war, it is different. In a war, there are people that are actually out to bring you down, and not your competitors. I mean, there's, you know, if you're Walmart, there are organizations out there that are out there trying to make sure that you don't open stores where they live. There
yeah.
are there are all sorts of wars that go out there, and there are hate sites out there. So it's yourdomainsucks.com. I mean, as indelicate as that is, that's what's out there. And so there are organizations that have an agenda. They are after you. And so you have to operate differently in that kind of situation. What you need to do is definitely you need to do all the things you would do in a crisis. You need to look at whether those organizations have a point. You have to try and engage with them. You have to have the public conversation in which you make your points if you disagree with what the organization's saying. But at a certain point, you may have to get to the point where you say, hey, look, this is not a crisis anymore. This is a war. I'm not going to persuade them. And so what you need to do is you need to make sure you're persuading everybody else. You need to make sure that you're persuading the public at large, that you're persuading your customers. And you have to really convince yourself that what these organizations are saying really is wrong and unfair. And then you need to enlist all the assets you have. You have to enlist partners, customers, anybody you can to join the public conversation to defend you. And some ways that they do that is just by taking on the thing directly, but other ways it's just talk about good things, talk about some other things besides what this organization is talking about. If you can discredit them, that, you know, legitimately, then you try and do those things. But, you know, a war is very different than a crisis because that's something that you're not going to resolve it with the person who is complaining. You're going to have to really resolve it in the court of public opinion.
In referring to all of these conversations and social marketing, things along that line, a lot of buzz terms we've been using, podcasting, blogging, all sorts of things. Blogging is something you've mentioned quite a few times, and probably most of our listeners are fairly familiar with. So, Mike, tell us a little bit how marketers should be using blogs.
The first thing that you need to use them for is to read them. I mean, you know, that's how you monitor what's going on, right? You have to, you know, stay in touch by reading what people are talking about. I mean, it used to be that there were only some businesses that were talked about in the media. There were only some industries that had any coverage. Well, now almost, you know, every industry has somebody writing about it. And so you need to focus on who are the voices that make sense, who are the voices that your customers are listening to, and you have to listen to them so that you just stay in touch. But blogs can also be used by companies, right? And so you need to treat bloggers the same way you would treat journalists. I mean, Netflix, for example, has a blog that's written about them called Hacking Netflix, and it's a very popular blog. It's got, I think, 250,000 subscribers. And so Netflix treats Mike Kalchny, who's the author of the Hacking Netflix blog, they treat him the same way they would treat the New York Times. I mean, when they unveiled their newest offering where they could download movies, they brought five journalists in, and one of them was Mike. And so why are they doing that? Because they know that Mike has an enormous influence over what their customers think. So if Mike thinks that this is a really, really great feature of Netflix, they're going to tell the 250,000 customers that, and it might stave off some of them saying, hey, you know what, I really think I should check out what Blockbuster is doing now. And Netflix now knows that that's an important way for them to get their message across. And so the first thing you do is you want to listen to what everybody's saying. Second thing you want to do is you want to treat bloggers like journalists, treat them with the same kind of importance, have your PR person be involved with them. The third thing you want to do is you want to write your own. And you don't write them from the PR department. You don't want to put out some kind of homogenized, blank, personless, third-party voice of the stuff that's been blessed from above. That's exactly the wrong thing to do. What you want to do instead is you want to encourage your employees to blog. And so there's a lot of procedures and policies that you want to build around that. There's training because your employees are not used to speaking in public necessarily, but that's a good thing because they're not going to check absolutely everything they say at the door, and they're not going to say everything in politically correct ways. They're going to be honest, and they're going to talk about things that your customers care about. You need to make sure that they don't do anything dumb. You need to make sure that they're not giving away trade secrets, that they're not saying horrible things about your competitors, that they're not doing anything that breaks the law. So there's a lot of things you have to train them so that they know how to do this. But if you do, and you really encourage it, I mean, Sun has over 3,500 employees blogging. I mean, that just has a huge impact on their reputation with their customers. The customers think that, gee, Sun is this very open place. I think I understand where they're going. I think I understand what they think. If I have a question about something, I can read up it in a blog. I can post a comment, and the guy will answer me. And, I mean, it's just this is the way that you get to communicate. And so, to me, those are the three main ways, right? The first way is you got to listen. Second way is you want to cultivate relationships with the important bloggers in your industry. And the third way is you want to have your employees really tell a human story of your own company.
Excellent summary. And Sun CEO has been a blogger for, what, several years now, hasn't he?
That's right. Jonathan Schwartz has a very well-respected blog. And there are other CEO bloggers out there as well. I mean, I know the head of the Ducati Motorcycle Company has a blog. He's not the CEO, but Bob Lutz in GM has a blog. I mean, there's a lot of high-ranking people. In IBM, Irving Wadowski-Berger has a blog. He's a very high-ranking executive in IBM. And so sometimes it's high-ranking executives, but you shouldn't think that that's all that you need to do, right? I mean, first of all, a lot of your executives, they're not cut out for this. They might not be good writers, or they might feel like they don't have the time to do this. So, you know, it's not the kind of thing you want to force on people, because if you force people to do it, it will show. What you instead want to do is invite people who have an interest in being heard and an interest in have an interesting point of view. Invite them and encourage them to take the time and do that. Give them time during their workday to do this kind of thing. Make sure that they understand it's important, and reward them for the impact they're having in the market by doing that. And so it's much better if people want to do it. Now, sometimes it'll be your executives, but most of the time it won't. It'll be people who are at much lower levels of your business, but that could be exactly the right thing for the message that you want to deliver.
You know, something else you touch upon in the book, Mike, that we're also hearing more and more about are these things called wikis. Can you tell us a little bit what they are?
Yeah, I mean, one way of thinking about it is it's kind of like a shared word processor.
Okay.
It's a place where anybody can update a web page or create a new web page. And there are a lot of companies using them. I mean, IBM uses them for all of our for some of our server customers. We've got a wiki out there that really talks about how the servers could be used, different problems that you might have if you don't set them up properly, and all sorts of information that IBM contributes, but also our customers contribute, because they learned, hey, look, what we said wasn't quite true in a certain situation. And so what they do is they update it and say, hey, look, that's correct, except if you have this situation, in which case you have to do this too. And that makes the information a lot better. Executive Travel Magazine is using wikis. I really liked what they were doing. They basically said to themselves, you know what? Our customers, our readers, are the ones who really, really understand travel tips. They really understand where the best place is to eat in Bangkok. They really understand where the best hotels are. Why don't we let them write about it? Why don't we put up wikis that have all sorts of different topic areas, and let our customers, our readers, come and post information and update them as things change, and correct things if they're wrong. I mean, that's really what you want to be able to do. And I mean, all of this, if you've never seen a wiki, just go to Wikipedia, which is, you know, an encyclopedia that's maintained by thousands of people. Now, is all the information there accurate all the time? No, it's not. But you're not necessarily caring about things being absolutely accurate as much as you're caring about what the amount of information is and how persuasive it is. because if you only want accurate information, you probably already have mostly accurate information out on your website. But there's only so much investment you're going to make in that information, and information that comes from you has only so much persuasive power. Information that comes from your customers is hugely more persuasive than information that comes from you. Think about what you look for when you're looking at buying something. Do you take whatever the company says at its word, or do you go check it with third parties who say this is the real skinny on this product or that product? Well, Wiki is something that's maintained by a group, and so that group of people ends up being more credible than if the information came from the company itself. And so if you have situations where you've got a lot of information-intense products, or you have a situation like Executive Travel does where you've got customers who know a lot about subjects that would be interesting, that would cause people to take more of an interest in your magazine, that's a great way to use a wiki.
Perfect. Tell us a little bit about, you know, in September 2007, your book, Do It Wrong Quickly, is available. And you talked a little bit earlier in our conversation about the importance of doing something, getting it out there, finding out whether it works, and doing something else. Can companies really afford to do this amount of experimentation?
Well, honestly, I mean, I think we're getting to the point where they can't afford to avoid it. I mean, if you think about it, it's really very expensive to try to do it right slowly. It costs a lot of money. I mean, all these focus groups that you're doing and the amount of time that you're taking, all these people sitting in those conference rooms day after day, poring over the plan for one more showstopper. I mean, this costs a lot of money. It's very expensive. And the truth is that even though you've spent all of that time and money on those projects, if you level with yourself, if you're really honest in your heart of hearts, you have to admit that a whole bunch of them turned out to be wrong. Even with all the work you put in, a whole bunch of them turned out to miss the mark, maybe even in a major way sometimes. And so it's much cheaper for you to do something far more quickly. You don't have to modify it 59 times before it ever sees the light of day. But what you would want to do is you'd want to say, okay, look, if we're not going to spend all that time obsessing about making sure it's okay, here's what we do want to think about. We want to think about what are the 58 ways that it could be wrong. I mean, because that's what you spend all your time talking about in these meetings. You say, well, how about if customers think this? Won't they be offended by that? Or how about if our competitor decides they say this? Then we're going to look stupid if we said that. And so you have all these things that come up in those meetings that go on for months before you launch your campaign. Instead of having meetings where you're trying to somehow be proactive and defend against all these possible problems, why not just say to yourself, hey, look, if that happened, we'll change it to this. If this happens, we'll change it to that. If we find out that, then we'll do this. And so instead of just trying to figure out how to make the perfect thing, which, by the way, won't be perfect, what you do instead is you say, okay, here's what we're going to try, and we got plan A, B, C, D, E. We've got every different idea of what we would do if we found out that something was wrong about it. Because, by the way, you're going to find out something's wrong with it. The difference is if you do it this way, when you find out something's wrong about it, you fix it, and you fix it really fast. The other way, you've obsessed for months to try and make something that's perfect, but if something is wrong that you didn't think of, or even if it is something you thought of, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't just go back to the drawing board and say, oh boy, I guess we'll fix it. It's really hard to fix the old way. You're not prepared to fix it. And one of the reasons is because if you spend all these months obsessing over getting it right, by the time you're done, the groupthink has kicked in and you have absolutely convinced yourself that this is good, because you couldn't have spent all this amount of time if you didn't get to the point that you convinced yourself and you've convinced your boss that it's good and you've told the big executive that it's good. You've told everybody how great this is going to be. And so at that point, when you launch it, you don't want to hear any feedback. You don't want to hear what's wrong with it. You just want to defend yourself and say, well, you know, that was only a small percentage of customers that said that, or yes, we know that sales were a little bit off, but, you know, we really think that once we get into the Christmas season, that's when this message is really going to resonate. I mean, you come up with all sorts of reasons not to change it because your reputation's on the line having said that it's going to work. And what I'd say instead is forget all that. Tell everybody, we know this is wrong. We don't know how it's wrong yet. There's a lot of ways it could be wrong, but we're going to put it out there. We're going to test it for a week or a day or a month. It depends on how many people you get, how long you have to test it. And if it's not working, here are all the things we could try. Here's all the changes we can make. Here's the things we could do instead. Here's the way we could modify it. And we're going to try each of those in turn, and eventually we'll figure out what it is. And I bet you, if you do it the way I'm suggesting, you will find a really, really good answer in the same amount of time that it took you to obsessively find the first attempt the first time. But it'll be way better. And that's the difference. The difference is that you kind of can't afford to do it the old way. You don't have the time or the money, and you don't have the luxury of being wrong for a long period of time before you can come back and fix it. And what you really need to do is to admit to yourself that you can afford to be wrong for a short period of time as long as you're following a process that will eventually get you to the right thing. And that's why you need to measure everything you do. That's why you need to bring these direct marketers into the business so they can tell you how you know when it's working. So it's not just listening to whether customers like it on the blogosphere. It's also checking to see how many people clicked on that, how many people came to our site, how many people bought. And you have to analyze those things. And when those numbers are going up, whatever you did was good. Do more of it. When they're going down, that's bad. Go back to what you had before or change it in a different way and then see what happens. So do it wrong quickly and then fix it is much cheaper than to try and obsessively do it right slowly.
You know, what I really liked about what you advocate in the book, Mike, and in the examples you're giving is all this feedback comes from customers rather than speculation that comes out in group meetings, thrown on a whiteboard, and what your colleagues think. It's the people you're trying to sell to that are giving you, this isn't working and here's what to do.
Right. To me, it's the difference. I mean, what the shift in marketing is a shift from trying to get attention to having to pay attention. I mean, the old kind of marketing is always people trying to show everybody, hey, look, here's my message. I have to get people's attention. I have to get the awareness. I have to make some kind of fuss so that people will notice me. And it's like, and I'm not saying that that's no longer important. It's always going to be important. But the shift is that you also have to pay attention. You have to pay attention to how customers are responding, to what they're doing, to whether they're buying, to what they're saying about you. So you have to have really this feedback culture. You have to, and that's one of the things that's hard is you have to change your culture inside your company to say, here is how we're going to listen to the customer. We're going to listen to what they say, we're going to watch what they do, and we're going to modify what we're doing in response. And that's different from kind of a consensus-driven culture where everybody is trying really hard to make sure that they don't get blamed for something going wrong. I mean, that's a very different kind of culture, and it's probably the biggest change that especially large companies have to make.
You know, and Do It Wrong Quickly is the title of your book. Tell us about the quickly part of the title. You know, how can businesses kind of speed up the pace of their marketing?
I have to tell you that this is one of the things that people will struggle with the most. People are used to working in a certain pace, and I think the hard part is trying to figure out how to do things faster. And so just admitting to yourself that something's wrong is going to cause you to do things faster because you can cut off that beginning part of the process where you're obsessively trying to search for showstoppers before you even try something. And so that can help you do things faster. But the place that's really challenging is the responsiveness. You have to really commit yourself to saying up front, what are we measuring as success here? So what is our success measurements? And I spend a lot of time in the book trying to explain how you measure different situations. What is the overall theory of how you can measure what customers are doing on the web? And you also have to know, what is your website for? What's its purpose? I mean, is your website to sell things in e-commerce, or is your website to cause people to contact you offline by filling out a form that has their email address in it? What is it you're trying to get people to do? And so you have to use web analytics programs to figure out how you can do these things. And so that in itself gives you some pace, because what happens is if you say to yourself, we're going to see what the customers did today, and then that will force you to start making decisions to react to that, and that'll move your pace up. I think the biggest problem with pace is actually that most of the things that you need to do involve some kind of technology. And one of the things that especially large companies need to do, but small companies need to as well, is they need to change the way that they develop and deploy technology. They have to use what they call agile methodologies. So they can't have this incredible process where they bring the IT people in and they explain what their requirements are, and then they write a book about that, and then the IT people write a book about all the things they're going to do, and then they have this long schedule with a long and distinguished set of tasks, and they have Gantt charts that show which task is dependent on the next. And that's just, you can't respond when that's the way you operate, right? Because by the time that project's over, all your needs have changed, and it just doesn't work anymore. What you need to do is use agile methodologies where you basically say, hey, it's a train schedule. Every month, we're going to change the technology on the website. And so the marketers can come and say, here are the most important things to us. And the technology people can say, okay, well, this one you could really get next month. These other ones are going to take longer. And some marketers say, okay, do that one next month. And then they do it. And whatever they don't get done doesn't ship that month, but the train comes on time. So every month the website changes. And you don't know how many passengers are on that train every month. So it could be that some things didn't work and they have to delay it till the month after. But it's better than the way we do it now, which is unless you've written all of the stuff unless you've developed all the stuff that's written in that book, you delay the project. And so It was supposed to take a year, but it ends up taking a year and 4 months because they had to fix everything that was in the book before they can go. And what you need to do is use agile methodologies that say, we're always ready to ship. We're always ready to update the website. We just don't know how much function's going to be in it. But we always know when it's going to happen. And so and the marketers get to tell us when it is that we're going to update. I mean, we do this at IBM.com, but we do this at a lot of other companies too.
Mike, tell me, in my company, if I'm wanting to implement more a do-it-wrong-quickly type philosophy and also become engaged in social marketing, tell me a little bit how I should go about doing this and also how I should go about getting support from others within my company to go along with this effort.
I think the place to start is with listening and watching. So the place to start, and it's usually easy to persuade people that you ought to listen to what your customers say and you ought to watch what they do. I mean, most people will go along with that. So
right.
I think that's a key place that you start. And the first thing you have to do is actually do those things. So, you know, and you can do this wrong quickly too, right? You don't have to say, okay, I need to get every person in the company to agree that this is the globally correct approach for doing marketing now. No.
Right.
What you can do is say, hey, look, let's take this incredibly intractable problem that we've had. So we send out emails every month, and every month the open rate on the emails goes down. And that's bad. So, and we've tried several different fixes for it. I mean, we tried one last year. We tried one 2 months ago. And now everybody's arguing what the next one should try because we still don't know what's going on. And instead of coming into there and saying, okay, look, do it wrong quickly is what you need to do here. We need to experiment. We shouldn't be trying one solution every 8 months. We should be trying five in a month and see what happens. And instead of coming in and trying to convince people that this is exactly the way to do it, instead what you do is you say, hey, look, all of you have good ideas. So these five people who say, you know, try my idea next. No, try my idea next. No, try my idea next. Instead what you do is if your company is built on consensus, and the way that this would work out is you'd spend 2 months with everybody arguing with each other until you decide which one to try next, you can come in and say, hey, look, I got this new way of trying this thing. What we could do is let's try all of them. So in the next 4 weeks, in the next 5 weeks, we'll try a different one of those every week. So your idea was to change the way that we do the metrics because you think the reason the open rate's going down is because people are blocking images and our numbers are wrong. So let's test that. you think that the problem is that we have really lousy subject lines in the messages. Well, let's try putting better subject lines in and test that. And you go down the list and you say, everybody's got a different idea what to do. Let's try them all and let's see what happens. And you'll find that because it's a really important problem to the organization, they're going to forget about how they usually do things and say, oh, that's a great idea. Let's just go try it. And so then you have to make sure that you know exactly what the metric is that you're going to analyze. So your metric in this case is the open rate. And so just accept that. Now, I'll tell you, I think that's a ridiculous thing to be trying to optimize. Nobody cares how many emails get opened. What you care is how many of those emails that you sent out actually got a customer to buy something. That's what you really care about. But do it wrong quickly. Now is not the time to go convince the whole organization that they have the wrong metrics.
Sure.
It's later. So first try and just get them to agree that we want to respond to what the customers are doing. Good. We also want to have a measurement that tells us whether it's working or not. Good. We also want to experiment with as many different solutions as fast as possible. Good. Take that. That's a good way. Is that the right way to do your marketing? No. There's 15 other things you should be doing too. But do that wrong quickly too. Go after this stuff in whatever steps you can take. So you don't convince the whole organization to change. What you do is you pick one problem and you take as many of the steps as you can with that problem. And then when you're all done, you declare success. And the way you declare success is, first of all, one of them might really have worked. If it did, great. But you can also declare success just by saying, hey, look, guys, if we had done everything the old way, it would have taken us 2 years to try all these ideas.
Sure.
Instead, we tried them in a month. So you guys are smart. What's five more we can try next month?
And look at all the information they gained in the process.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. And that's exactly what you need to do is you need to just challenge people to go after their hard problems with things that you really can do quickly. So, I mean, it has to be something feasible. So it can't be – if the first thing you think you want to do is to get your development team to change to agile development, that's probably not the one to start with. But what you can start with is how are you going to solve problems that really have a bunch of different things you could try quickly, and you want to just short-circus this whole make sure the next one we do is the right one attitude.
Mike, you know, your book titled Do It Wrong Quickly, it comes out September 2007. How can people get your book, Mike?
At the moment, they can't get it.
No, but
but eventually.
Always come to your website, I imagine.
If you come to my website, there's one thing. If you come to my website, which is at mikemoran.com, as soon as the book is available for pre-order, you'll know about it. The other thing that you can do is I have a lot of information about this concept on my website already. I mean, in my Biznology newsletter and blog,
right.
I've written extensively about these subjects and gotten a lot of good feedback on it. That's what caused me to decide to put it in a book. And so they can get a lot of information there now. But, yes, if they subscribe to my newsletter, they subscribe to my blog, they'll find out as soon as it's available for pre-order, and they'll be able to pick up a copy then.
And that's at Mike, MikeMoran.com. I know for sure as well. We'll keep posted on our blog at rssray.com/blog. We'll keep all the details, and when the book's available, you'll be able to click through and get it off our site as well. Mike, thanks for the time. We appreciate your information you've shared with us. I'm sure Do It Wrong Quickly. I've read a preview copy of the book. I highly recommend it. And again, thanks for the time, sir.
Thank you very much, Ray. I really appreciate it.
Bye, Mike.
Bye.